Last summer, when discussing vaccine distribution, a colleague eloquently articulated a common view about the obligations of our political representatives. I quote him with permission. He wrote, "The job of the U.S. government is to use U.S. resources and tax revenues to help U.S. citizens and, to a large extent, U.S. residents first. Helping foreigners is nice to the extent it doesn't interfere with our ability to help our own. Indeed, my view is that it would be deeply unethical for our public servants, who are not the public servants of foreign countries, to do otherwise. This, of course, is our normal ethical judgment as to policy decisions." Well, I think this normal ethical judgment is mistaken, but it's entirely understandable if you hold a familiar view of political representation as the implementation in collective settings of our rights of self-determination conceived in terms of the pursuit of our interests. On this view, we the people enable our political representatives to pursue our interests by largely transferring our rights of self-determination to them. Their remit is then limited by the circumference of our interests. As a consequence of this view's popularity, our political discussions of foreign aid are morally contorted by discussions of whether saving foreign nationals' lives would ultimately benefit U.S. citizens, making the absolutely wrong considerations primary and often exclusive. Of course, one way to tackle this myopic position is to argue that in this case, a duty to others constrains the scope of our rights of self-determination. And in one sense, that's correct, but it's a patchy solution to a view that, as I will discuss, encounters other difficulties. The foreign aid distortion and the other problems I will canvas trace to two related causes. Namely, first, the familiar view conceives of the representation relationship as one of the sharing of normative powers, grounded in a fundamental, non-derivative, self-oriented, interest-protecting right, rather than as a relationship grounded in sharing other regarding duties and the powers necessary to implement them. And second, the familiar view conceives of the representation relation as conforming to a hierarchical principal-agent model in which the agent's judgment must generally hew and defer to the principal's judgments and interests. Notice my colleague's double reference to public servants. Neither of these ideas fit comfortably with an egalitarian theory of democracy, in which we all have duties of justice to our fellow domestic citizens, duties of humanity and beneficence, and perhaps justice, to our fellow global citizens, and arguably other collective duties, for example, to animals. For the sake of brevity, henceforth, I'll refer to this list as our collective moral duties, and I'll often use duties of justice as a representative example. Roughly, I have in mind duties that each of us has by virtue of our membership in a group that we each have to an equal degree, and that prior to the designation of our roles and the circumstances of application are identical. I will not here say more about their specific content, except to affirm that their content is not empty, that whatever privacy the interests of our fellow citizens exert within the correct theory of justice and international obligations, our domestic interests certainly do not take lexical priority over all else, and that our democratic commitments, as well as the satisfaction conditions of many of these duties, require a co-authored, communicative legal system through which they are fulfilled. Taking these as assumptions, my emphasis here will be on making some aspects of the structure of our co-authorship more prominent in our conception of representation by reframing how it is that power emanates from the people. We should understand its predominant form not as a transfer of a fundamental right of individual self-determination, but rather as a delegation of fundamental collective moral duties shared by one's fellow citizens and hence by one's representatives as fellow citizens. On this reconceptualization, foreign aid will not represent an abrogation of or a limitation on representation, but rather as an instance of its core exercise. This alternative model of political representation as duty-centered also comes hand in hand with a more robust picture of citizen participation. That does a picture in which we imagine that political officials are our appointed servants, taking care of essential matters while we do other more important things. Although this conceptualization is not commonplace, a duty-centered approach to politics isn't exactly novel either. For example, although Rawls devotes surprisingly little attention to representation, his brief remarks gesture at a duty-centered conception of politics and representation. Constitutional design, in his theory, is aimed at procedures that generate just and effective legislation, which is also the citizen's first interest in government. Justice requires that political parties do not act as mere interest groups, but that they advance and are guided by a conception of the common public good. Representatives' first priority is to use their judgment to enact just legislation and only secondarily to further their constituents' compatible interests. Although his approach is duty-centered, it's less clear whether it is a duty delegation model in particular, because it's unclear whether Rawls thinks in terms of legitimate power as emanating from the people, or even whether he believes a theory should supply its functional normative equivalent, in much the way he thinks that justification from the original position should substitute for the moral value of actual individual voluntary consent to be governed. For my part, I think the distinct idea of popular sovereignty has a normative importance that cannot be fully captured merely by demonstrating that the structure of government is justified. As I argue in Democratic Law, on analogy with individual moral action, the adequate fulfillment of our political duties of mutual respect to one another has both a structure or an outcome component and also a collective moral motive component. The motive component is satisfied through our expressive collective activities of endorsement and commitment to just arrangements through democratically formed law. One way to think of this idea is that it's important that justice be done, that it be seen to be done, and that we actually participate in its being done by us in our name. Adequate discharge of many of our collective duties, including our duties of mutual respect, requires us to exist harmoniously within a just basic structure and to cooperate with our compatriots to co-author and construct the terms of this required structure so that when government acts and speaks, we are acting and speaking. Understanding democracy, then, requires understanding the relationship between representation and egalitarian co-authorship. And by exploring the resources of the duty delegation model, I aim to revive attention to a duty-centered approach to politics, to enrich its democratic features, to highlight some implications for the relationship between representative and constituent, and to draw out some ramifications concerning the duties of citizenship, especially the relationship between citizens and the law. But I'm going to start at some distance from politics and representation by first tracing some of the philosophically interesting and distinctive features of transferring and sharing normative power when that power emanates from a duty. Then I'll proceed to describe how duty delegation might be a way to understand democratic representation and what its implications are for the representative. And finally, I'll conclude by describing the centrality of citizen participation in a flourishing democratic legal system. So let's begin with duty delegation. As part of the growing interest in the ethics of relationships, talk of normative powers and their transfer is all the rage. But the bulk of attention has been directed at powers that derive from rights, and the individual and moral advantages of possessing these powers, as with the powers of consent, or the advantages of transferring them to a beneficiary, as with promising. These discussions often have in mind rights grounded in autonomy values, as with some rights over personal property, many rights over the body, or rights to make personal decisions or to express oneself. For many simple rights, by which I mean rights not derived from duties, permanent or long-term alienation is possible. I can give or sell my property, like my extra egg beaters, or I can promise to attend your niece's graduation to promote family harmony, and thereby I lose my normative power for me rather than you to decide otherwise. Sometimes alienation amounts to a central expression and not merely an exercise of the autonomy that the rite enshrines. That's how some people conceive of marriage. Often, with rites, their transfer is temporary and more qualified. The rights holder retains the ultimate power, but for a period lends it or shares it to another. You can rent and occupy my property, but only under certain conditions. To enhance my influence or free my time, I can pay and empower you to serve as my agent. I consent that you can use my normative powers for a time and for a qualified purpose. You may examine me, you may speak for me or act for me, but ultimately I retain control to make the decisions about where your acquired powers will be directed. Because your acquired normative power to act emanates from my simple right to control a matter, and because that right is grounded in the value of choice, or the benefits the right brings to me, it's often assumed that the temporary possessor must serve my interests and defer to my judgment, unless such deference confronts another duty like a prohibition. So that's the rights transfer picture, but we've given a lot less attention to how the transfer and sharing of normative powers associated with duties, namely their delegation, might enter our picture. The neglect is strange because many powers and rights arise because they are necessary to execute a duty. For example, the putative right and power to direct and arrange one's child's education would have to derive from a parental duty to ensure one's child's welfare and development. The justification for this power and its delegation will have more to do with the needs giving rise to the duty than with the salutary effects that power has for the parent or his delegates. Considering these normative powers that trace their origins to duties complicates the simple picture of transfer that I have described, both with respect to efforts at alienation and to more limited transfers of power. First, given their nature, the alienation and partial transfer of duties is usually not a simple matter of exercising one's will, as it may be in cases of consent and promises that do not impose significant externalities. Although there are certainly cases of incapacity that justify relinquishing parental responsibility, you can't permanently renounce or outsource some or all of your parental duties at will, because those duties are importantly personal and specific to their holder. The resistance of duties to transfer is not restricted just to these cases of intimate relationships, though. After all, if I have a responsibility to certify that the water quality meets minimal standards, I can't just offload that responsibility and its correlate powers to just anyone. There are complex procedures by which I may revise or quit my station, and that in turn will affect a wide range of my duties, powers, and rights. In standard cases, picking out a particular duty or a range of duties to alienate or share is not a matter of our mutual preferences. The grounding of the duty will restrict whether I can alienate it or share it at all, with whom, and for what reason. But at the same time, you have to recruit assistance to manage your duties well and to retain your sanity. Given their complexity and the complexity of our social circumstances, the execution of duties often cannot be a solitary affair, but requires the cooperation of others and consequently their empowerment by the original duty holder. To be sure, some duties are more outcome-oriented than personal, so that the successful arrangement of a relevant state of affairs will count as that duty's satisfaction, whether or not the duty holder personally delivers. But even in these cases, the duty holder retains ultimate responsibility should the arrangements fail. And this form of ongoing, ineliminable responsibility represents a notable feature of duty delegation. Even when a duty holder may share the powers necessary to fulfill a duty and may temporarily make another person the point person, the duty cannot be entirely sloughed off, even temporarily, just at will. Parents may authorize a bus driver to be responsible for taking their child to school. But if the bus doesn't arrive, some parent must drive the child to school, even if the bus driver is at fault, but parents are still on the hook to take measures to fulfill the duty. To use a familiar term, short of alienation, successful duty delegation leaves a residue, even when one permissibly relocates the performance obligation in another. The duty is sticky, enough that one must play the role of backup. The stickiness of duties might be thought to lend succor to a hierarchical principal-agent model of delegation. Since the delegator does bear the ultimate responsibility for the duty's fulfillment and is the source of the delegate's power, it may seem fitting that the delegator's directions and her judgment be authoritative. And on the surface, some examples seem to conform to this model. For instance, parents choose daycare providers, give directions about their parenting philosophies and preferences, and retain the power to terminate if the provider does not conform. But this description is misleading, and the temptation to embrace a hierarchical principal-agent model should really be resisted even here. Because after all, the original duty is not seated in the duty holder to celebrate her judgment or protect her reputation. What should govern the delegation relationship and the division of power within it is the duty's ground and the appropriate mechanisms of its fulfillment. So let's re-describe the example. The parent delegates partial responsibility to a daycare provider for a child, as well as the power to fulfill that responsibility. The role of the daycare provider may then inflect the duty in ways that are not entirely controllable by the parent. The daycare provider may need a license, and to serve the children well, that license may require certifications and regular updates the parent would not choose, increasing the price. It may require the daycare provider to report suspected abuse or do her own health checks, whether the parent accedes or not. Morally, the daycare provider must treat children of all genders equally and allow them to play with the same toys, even if the parent's preference and practice is patriarchal. The daycare provider must not lie in response to a child's age-appropriate questions, even if the parent requests mendacity about certain topics. These requirements are not, as would say attorney licensing, for the sake of the transferor, the rights holder, or for the sake of an administrable system or to control externalities. These requirements reflect what is necessary for the execution of the duty to the child by the occupant of the role. Still, it's true that the parent retains ultimate responsibility for ensuring the child's welfare, and this will give the parent an oversight role over her delegate, including a power to terminate. But we should not infer that an oversight role and the de facto range of power it brings entails that the parent has the moral authority to dictate all manner of terms and to terminate the relationship over any difference about how that duty is executed. The practical leverage that's bestowed to facilitate an oversight relation can exceed the moral bounds and purposes over which the delegator should exercise that power. This is not merely because the parent may be mistaken, but also because through delegation, the parents put the delegate into direct contact with the grounds of duty generation. The provider's duties and power with respect to the child begin with the access and normative power bestowed by the parent, but the provider's normative role cannot be reduced to acting as a mere conduit for the parent's instructions, because the provider's role is to enter into a direct, caring, duty generation relationship with the child. The delegate has her own responsibility as a moral agent to use her agency and apply her judgment to discharge the duties generated by that relationship faithfully. Although the parent's judgment about the care should have substantial weight, it's not normatively controlling. The caregiver may reasonably think that the parent knows more about the child's welfare, and for that epistemic reason, he should usually defer to the parent's judgment. And further, because the parent is the primary caretaker and will have to integrate any consequences of the caregiver's decision into the parent's plan, the caretaker also has that coordinating reason to give substantial deference to the parent's judgment to ensure a cohesive plan for the child. Reasons of deference can also arise in light of the value of the parental relationship, inhering in part through the participant's evolution through an asymmetric relationship of care, dependence, authority, and responsibility into one of mutual care and interconnected independence. But nonetheless, since the caregiver's responsibility is to the child, emanating from the child's needs and their own relationship, it's not fulfilled just by following orders. The caregiver has to develop and apply her own judgment about what the duty in context requires. And that judgment must incorporate and give substantial weight to a parent's judgment, but cannot merely reflect it. A parent may declare that she wants her child to gain exposure to unmasked children to bolster the child's immunity, but that judgment need not dictate what the caregiver does as a matter of fealty. The buck makes a pit stop at the caretaker before ending with the parent, and it might turn out that the pit stop requires masks. Thus, respect for the delegate's moral agency and responsibility, and for the child-delegate relationship, militates that the delegator should not morally consider herself the dictator of the delegated relationship. It's more of a supervised collaboration that requires coordination as well as making some room for the delegate's judgment. Because the delegator has greater actual than normative power, she must use her moral discretion to align the two in ways that are consistent with both the underlying duty to the child and with respect for the delegate's moral agency. So far, I've used an everyday case to illustrate 4 points about duty delegation. First, there are distinct obstacles to their alienation and transfer at will. Second, where delegation is permissible, the delegator retains accountability for the duty's fulfillment. Third, the delegate himself is accountable to the duty and its source, and not just accountable to the delegator. And fourth, the contours of duties may morph depending on who has them rather than who delegated them. These observations, in turn, have implications for the relationship between delegate and delegator. The delegate's role involves some independent judgment, as I've been stressing, rather than mere substitution or amplification of the delegator's judgment. And second, the power-sharing relationship itself contains within it moral elements, requiring sound discretion and mutual respect for the boundaries and roles of both delegator and delegate. And I think these points illustrate some hazards of thinking of duty delegation as a model in which the delegate just serves to carry out the delegator's aims. They illustrate also some of the hazards of thinking of the duty delegation relationship as a simple division of labor. You take these hours, I'll take those. If there's any work left over, we'll see who has time. Delegating responsibility is distinct from simply delegating a task. When a new moral agent is both enabled and trusted with a responsibility, the moral terrain described by the duty shifts, both in terms of what can be achieved in the service of the duty, because the delegate may be more capable, or perhaps less capable in various regards than the delegator, and the moral terrain may shift with respect to what obligations reside in the delegator's portfolio. The delegator may not merely lighten her load by delegation. She may pick up new collaborative responsibilities, including respecting and ceding space to the delegate's judgment, taking on new tasks that only arise in light of the delegate's role, abilities, and decisions, and potentially refraining from otherwise standard behaviors so as to maintain continuity or to preserve a previously unattainable standard that the delegate sets. So I'm going to now move to political representation. Having sampled some of the moral intricacies of duty delegation in an everyday case that involves asymmetrical power, I want to turn to political representation, where I think we often implicitly vacillate between a duty delegation and a rights transfer model, and we often wield a hierarchical model, even though our democratic context calls for an egalitarian model. So first, let me describe the vacillation. Discussions of citizenship often invoke the language of duty, citing the duty to vote or the civic duty to serve on a jury. But then, oddly, the idea of duty fades into the background when we start to think about representation. Rather than thinking of a representative as one's delegate in the execution of a duty, we talk as though the representative is the represented's agent, is beholden to the represented's interests, needs, desires, or judgments. As my colleague's comments about vaccine distribution indicated, the idea is that the representative acts ultra vires if she contributes to any aim, like a global humanitarian aim, that cannot be reconstructed as a pragmatic maneuver entirely rooted in the representative's interests. But if you think about it, the combination of civic duty talk and rights-oriented representation models is peculiar. If by voting we collectively transfer simple rights of self-governance to our representatives, so that our representatives are supposed to act in our stead to implement our interests or needs or chosen ends, how does that square with the duty to vote? Is it a duty to oneself to ensure that political power is responsive to one's own needs and interests? That interpretation seems strange given the very common ambivalence about duties to self. It also makes very little sense of the fact that the duty to vote, to serve on a jury, and other civic duties of participation are all invoked in the same breath. Yet the duty of jury service is even harder to wrangle into a duty to self-frame. Well, maybe the idea is that we each have rights to self-determination. We transfer them to representatives who must exercise them on our behalf, beholden to our directions and interests. But this, in turn, generates a mutually beneficial system that we must maintain through voting and indirectly through jury service. Maybe that's right, but it still remains unclear how the right to self-determination, so understood, relates to our collective moral duties, our duties of justice. It seems rather strange that we would have a collective duty of justice, one that our representatives in some way are bound to pursue and that infiltrates all aspects of our collective life, but our collective duty and their empowerment are unrelated. And instead, their empowerment arises from a right of our self-determination that is somehow understood as separate from our duty of justice, but then perhaps is constrained and diverted at every turn by our duty of justice? I find this convoluted description absurd when it's spelled out, but it seems to me to be implicit in many discussions of representation. I suggest a more straightforward model of duty delegation might make a congenial difference to theorizing about representation and citizenship. Suppose our collective duties of justice did not so much constrain and divert what our representatives can do for us, but instead lay at the root of their empowerment. We have a duty to install and maintain an institutional system of justice, and for reasons both theoretical and practical, even with all the will in the world, that duty's fulfillment requires divisions of labor involving representatives whose full-time occupation is to deliberate about, construct, and maintain such institutions, and to master the relevant knowledge to pull it off. On the model of democracy to which I subscribe, these divisions of labor require active citizen participation to construct them and to select these representatives, because our duties of justice require actions, outcomes, and the forms of expression endorsing those actions and outcomes. On this picture, our duty to vote is not primarily a downstream duty to contribute to a system of accountability of a scheme of mutual benefit. Our duty to vote is an aspect of the primary provision of justice and the satisfaction of our other collective duties, of our lending our judgment and endorsement to the process of articulating what our duties require, and to the selection of who is well-suited to articulate and implement them. On this understanding, the framing of some persistent debates about the representative's mandate seem inappropriate. I have in mind those debates about whether the representative should vote for the constituent's own sense of the constituent interest her perceived tutored sense of the constituent interest, or her judgments about the national interest, which bear a complex relationship to the constituent's interest. All of these debates seem out of place to me. The representative is not delegated to pursue her constituent's interest in particular, whether objectively understood, subjectively understood, collectively understood, or as constituted after a dialogic, deliberative, dynamic interaction. Nor is it obvious to me that the representative is empowered only to serve the interests, the actual or perceived general public interest, as suggested by my colleague. We may have special duties to establish a polity and some special duties to our co-members, but it's really inconceivable that our collective duties do not range outside our community. When our representatives distribute resources to extraterritorial recipients, they're not curtailing their representation for the sake of an external duty, nor need extraterritorial assistance be prudential to avoid charges of illegitimacy. Their actions are as straightforward as their decisions on any other policy matter. Namely, they are actions taken to discharge our collective duty. So our understanding of representation and the constituent-representative relationship would also register pretty differently on a duty delegation model. On this model, the citizen's right to vote is not primitive or foundational. It originates in their collective duties and the normative powers those duties generate. By voting, citizens share some of their power to execute these duties, and importantly, the representative, as a citizen, shares the exact same duties of justice with her constituency prior to election, and they persist after she steps down from office. Unlike many agents, the political representative does not have any special distance from the conditions that ground the empowerment relation. And this marks a big contrast with the childcare case and lots of familiar principal-agent relationships. In those cases, the delegate does not have the duty in question prior to the onset of the delegation relationship. And should the delegator terminate the relationship, the delegate's acquired duties expire or at least substantially contract. But by contrast, our political representatives are citizens among others who share the same exposure to the effects of their duty-related actions as the rest of her community. If the representative and constituents share the same duty, then the idea that the delegator's primary relationship to the duty grounds any authority claim is implausibly strained. As a part of their accountability role, delegators may have the authority to remove the representative, whether on grounds of malfeasance or disagreement or something in between. But that power to terminate does not translate into any normative power or expectation to demand that the representative's decisions mirror the delegator's judgments. So, if the duty is shared prior to the delegation and collectively shared across the population, what do I think the relationship between the representative's judgment and the citizen delegator's judgment is? Does the representative have any kind of special relationship with the representative's unique constituents? Why would there be local districts at all? Well, on a duty delegation model, the primary work of a representative is to contribute to the execution of our collective duties, which is not unique to the representative's constituents. But still, in some systems and some polities, especially depending on size, local districts can play an important role in the execution of our collective duties directly and indirectly. Organizing at least some political solutions around localities provides the occasions to experiment, to tailor solutions to specific populations, to build the kind of distinctive community character that inspires community attachment and participation, and to develop knowledge about the community, its needs, and its figures. The specialized knowledge that's possible in a locality makes local constituents of larger political entities more informed about potential representatives than they would be about a large slate of national candidates. And moreover, representatives may bring important local information to the assembly that bears on the proper execution of our collective duties. In that sense, representatives owe special duties to their constituents that's grounded in their constituents' epistemic expertise, to ensure that their needs and circumstances are understood, and further that constituents' opinions about what justice requires are registered and engaged with. But this special duty should not be understood as situated within a large-scale bargaining situation. Rather, it's situated in a large-scale epistemic investigation of the requirements and sites for justice to be done and endorsed. The difference between these two framings of a bargaining situation and an epistemic investigation emerges when you consider more socially visible constituencies. With respect to those constituencies whose needs are more regularly or reflexively recognized and serviced, often for structural reasons, their representatives should not be chastised for not fighting for the interests of their constituents, because their job is not to extract the best political bargain for their constituents. Their job is to work to ensure justice is done, and that may mean deprioritizing or sacrificing their constituents' interests, narrowly understood. Hence, asking whether fealty to constituents requires pursuing actual, perceived interests or informed preferences is inappropriate, because the duty in question is not to constituents' interests or preferences as such, and because fealty is the wrong understanding of the duty delegation relation. The more pertinent question is about how to collaborate between representatives and constituents, to what degree the representative's judgment should yield to her constituent's sense of our collective duties. And the pragmatic calculations for re-election purposes may be similar, how much deviation will constituents tolerate, but the relevant normative considerations are very different. So, although the delegator's residual duty transforms oversight from a pragmatic to an obligatory affair, the oversight relation depends on the nature of the relevant duty and the associated collaboration. In part, constituents and representatives are engaged in an epistemic collaboration with a division of epistemic and agential labor. Constituents attempt to select representatives they think well suited to the prospect of identifying policies and crafting laws to realize our collective duties and to communicate citizens' sincere commitment to justice. Because many of the details involve specialized knowledge, constituents have some reasons to defer to representatives who cultivate expertise about technical areas and the political dynamics of representation and implementation. But those experts, even in their role as delegates, have reasons based in the nature of their delegated duty and role not to yield to popular pressure about technical matters. The delegator retains a residual duty to ensure that the duty is properly executed, using criteria that accommodates respect for the delegate's expertise and acknowledgement of disagreements about the content and scope of duty, to step in when there are lapses, and to perform those aspects of the duty that are non-delegable or otherwise not delegated. But it's important to remember that successful democratic legislation is not purely an instrumental matter, because many aspects of our collective duties have a collective expressive content. The collaboration between citizens and representatives is also expressive. And that expression predominantly occurs through the commitments involved in articulate law that is forged through democratic processes, including public debates, private conversation, regular input to representatives, notice and comment, litigation, protest, and elections. Citizens cannot expect fealty, but the alternative is not deferential abdication. When appropriate, their accommodation and acceptance of divergent judgments by representatives must accompany rather than replace the many kinds of active engagement that convey citizens' collective commitment to justice. But the expressive requirements of justice require more than constituent participation in the process. The achievement of the expressive function will be strained by apathy, but also by ongoing and substantial resistance to legislative outputs or omissions that exceed strong disagreement. Constituents have to be able to read legislative action and inaction as an interpretation, however flawed, of our joint commitments. That kind of reading is compatible with serious disagreement, and hence is consistent with being in a substantive minority. But it's not compatible with extended and deep disagreement that generates alienation. and ensuring that gaps of disagreement do not yawn into reasonable alienation requires representatives to be transparent and responsive in interactions, to respond to constituents as co-authors with whom they're in an ongoing conversation and cooperative negotiation about the content and interpretation of our shared commitments. That perspective does not demand that representatives vote their constituents' conscience rather than their own, nor that they always forge a compromise, but it may require that representatives ensure that their constituents' judgments are publicized. This dynamic process may ensure constituents that representatives are interpreting their shared commitments in good faith, and also will inevitably influence the content of constituents' and representatives' judgments. I'm now going to turn to other citizen duties. I've been discussing the relationship between citizens and representatives on a duty delegation model in the formation of law and policy. But there's one more dimension to constituent participation that affects our collective duties pertaining to implementation. We're more than familiar with citizen implementation in non-ideal cases, when the government just abdicates its responsibility and devolves power back to the citizenry to do individually what should have been done collectively. The Bushes, their plans for Social Security and their 1,000 points of light were famous for this. The fact that they thought that the work to be done required agents countable in the mere hundreds was already a clue that they failed to understand the gravity of the problem and the need for institutional action. But although the Bushes were champions of malfeasance, the strategy was not exclusive to them. Many pressing issues involving poverty, inequality, and climate have festered due to government malfeasance, which forces citizens individually and in associations to advance justice themselves, however haltingly, or to offer a partial solution for justice by providing contingent aid in the absence of a guarantee of a right. All that devolution is familiar, and it's very dispirited. But what I want to argue is that citizen implementation of law is not purely a feature of non-ideal conditions of government abdication. Even in ideal theory, in addition to those duties that involve constituting the state and co-authoring its duty-promoting measures, citizens have residual duties that take two forms. First, there are substantive duties beyond the purview of the state that were never delegated to the state, because state execution would be wholly inappropriate or infeasible, or because the state's role is properly understood as backup. Many think of the default custodial relation of intending parent to child in this way. And to cite a more controversial example, justice may require that socially we censure racist speech in ways or on occasions that exceed what it would be legitimate for the state to do, given the form that the state's guarantee of free speech must take. But second, the state may delegate duties back to citizens when it deems citizens important agents in legal implementation beyond the obvious case of issuing specific directives. I have in mind the generation and enabling of implicit and explicit expectations on citizens to engage in initiative and deliberation to further the law's aims. I think this is one way to understand the requirement of jury service, of self-reporting duties, like with taxes and the census, the role of the private attorney general, and the role of the whistleblower. And in addition to these discrete roles, there are lots of diffuse forms of what I call delegation back that occur whenever citizens need to engage in normative interpretation to understand or follow the law. This is evident in the use of standards in the law's articulation, when the law invokes notions of reasonability, good faith, fair dealing. But it also occurs very widely whenever there are gaps in the explicit law's articulation of how compliance is to be understood, measured, and verified. These gaps require all actors to behave in good faith, to consider how to achieve the law's purposes and how to reconcile their achievement with other social and legal norms. These gaps will arise from inevitable ambiguities and failures of foresight in articulating legal norms, and also when circumstances evolve from the initial conditions in place when the law was adopted, and from the intentional incorporation of discretion and flexibility in legal design. To be sure, the use of private agents to identify and implement the law has to be deployed with care so that their empowerment does not amount to an abdication to ensure fair procedures. Part of that responsibility also has to involve efforts to constrain and prevent the abuse of power between individual citizens. For example, there should be a very special reluctance to deputize citizens explicitly or through doctrines of self and other defense to use violence to enforce the law. Such deputizing on a sparing occasion can be justified, but without careful framing of the obligations of officials to show restraint and observe due process and equal protection, the hazards of abuse of citizen delegation to perform violence are high. They can be exacerbated by historical and cultural dynamics, and that's been our experience of the citizens' arrest power in encouraging and immunizing racist vigilantism. This is an area in which the delegate, here the state, is capable of setting and meeting a normative standard that the citizens cannot themselves set and meet. Or take Texas's recent effort to constrain women's reproductive freedom. It provides another cautionary tale. In essence, Texas's law bans abortion after the 6th week of pregnancy, but it abdicates enforcement by the state. It enables private citizens to sue anyone who performs, facilitates, or funds an abortion. That law's content is abhorrent, but so is its procedure. Motivated by an effort to circumvent constitutional accountability, it constitutes an insidious form of state abdication that fosters intimidation and distrust of one's neighbors and friends. But while I acknowledge these hazards, I think it's unwarranted to conclude that citizen involvement in legal implementation should be avoided entirely, and that we should support a monopoly on governance by state officials. That kind of monopoly for government to monopolize implementation risks the hazards of massive shortfalls in implementation, untenable levels of government scrutiny, and citizen distrust and alienation from government. A hefty degree of trust and responsibility has to be delegated back to citizens, and it has to be carefully tailored to ensure that this shared power does not come at the expense of public norms, impartiality, and rule distance. A generous level of self-reporting, self-monitoring, and self-enforcement is absolutely essential to avoid the trappings of an overbearing surveillance state and to securing a legal and social culture that features a robust level of basic liberties actually available for our exercise. Supplementary citizen involvement in the law can uncover information close to the ground, like with whistleblowing, and provides important normative feedback and disciplining of state excess. That is a function of jury service and community review boards. Citizen engagement with law can supply elusive information and independent perspectives about significant problems, as when enforcement by private attorneys general and private litigants supplement state omissions or provide the occasion for clarified interpretation, as in cases of first impression. In other cases, legal norms take concrete shape through citizen interpretation of their responsibilities to one another, as when legal interpreters look to best practices to establish legal expectations, or when the legal expectation is in a standard that requires reasonability or good faith, or unconscionability. These all require normative judgment to apply to a particular situation. Of course, some agents may be particularly poor at self-reporting, whether for predictable reasons of greed, or self-rationalization, or for contingent contextual reasons, and then one should shift the balance back to the government. Judicial reflection and oversight on these norms and practices may also be necessary to render them consistent with impartiality, fairness, and other norms, but that doesn't render these practices redundant. The way I think of it is that one should think of citizen-generated legal culture and judicial culture as having a mutually provocative and informative dynamic. So far, I have focused on citizen initiative in direct legal implementation. But you can also identify what I call delegation back when the cultivation of complementary social normative cultures and practices is crucial to a legal system's success, by which I mean it's achieving its aims without yielding to undue political pressure, resorting to exorbitant, undemocratic enforcement tactics, or generating an alienated, resistant population. One example is the development of a free speech social culture, by which I mean citizens themselves have to accept and practice a social culture of engaged listening, tolerance, and openness to dissent, partly in order to train to be officials who resist pressure to squelch unpopular speech, but mostly as everyday citizens to learn how to endure and manage the challenging, controversial, and even distasteful speech that a free speech legal culture makes room for. I think philosophers it's our job to make possible and to model this social culture. Often, the social culture and the legal culture will work on parallel principles, but many divergences may be appropriate given the different roles of private agents and state actors, and the prior example of social censoring of racist speech illustrates this. A further example might point to the need to establish a feminist, anti-racist culture of egalitarian interpersonal interactions to complement and support civil rights. And the point also makes hold of our economic relations. Contract law explicitly delegates back when it requires contractors to act in good faith toward one another, respond to each other's reasonable reliance. Its success also depends on the maintenance of a social culture of trust, honor, and enforceable forms of fair dealing. If these virtues were scarce in the social moral culture, contracts would be rarer. They'd be limited to those who could afford large forfeitable deposits and private enforcement. It's a more just society, that understood contract law as one of the many legal institutions that structure equitable forms of economic cooperation. Its successful operation would also require that contractors regularly show good faith to each other and that they bargain for only equitable prices, even when they enjoy a superior bargaining position. Notably, all of the delegations back I've just discussed about freedom of speech, economic relations, the feminist, anti-racist social culture, they all involve a transformation of the form the collective duty took prior to delegation. They take a particular shape that has been refined by the legal system's effort to instantiate justice. It doesn't do for citizens simply to set out armed with their knowledge of the original collective duty of justice. Their own judgments of what that collective duty requires or how it might best be realized may not dovetail with the actual collective effort that has been mounted. For example, some gender activists may think that gender equality and freedom would be best served without a state institution of marriage, but that given its existence, justice requires access to marriage for families, whatever their gender composition, and it requires support for such marriages. Their delegated duties returned back to citizens, refracted through the institutions, and the layers upon layers of particularized decisions about how to instantiate justice that institutional policy and legal decisions represent. So I'll conclude. I've been exploring the resources and the implications of a model that regards duty delegation as the primary foundational source of representative power. It offers a more unified account of the continuity between citizens' political duties and the responsibility of representatives. A more unified account than is offered by hierarchical models that cast representatives as our loyal agents in our exercise of our simple rights of individual self-determination. It also makes greater sense of the appropriate balance of power between citizens and good faith disagreements about the content It also makes greater sense of the appropriate balance of power between citizens and representatives in a democracy, and of the significant responsibility that citizens bear in making democratic institutions work. Such a view need not exclude the complementary pursuit by representative bodies of common interests and common ends that are consistent with but not required by duty. Indeed, that pursuit may indirectly contribute to the kind of community individuation that makes places interesting and elicits community affiliation, which in turn motivates participatory engagement. The relationship between duty delegation and a secondary mission of the pursuit of common interests and ends can synergize. So we can recast all these points by rethinking what the right of self-determination involves in a political context. The language of self-determination and its use in other contexts lends itself to thinking, as my colleague did, mainly of exercises of unbounded individual autonomy and personal expression. And that, in turn, lends itself to thinking of one's agents or one's representatives as mere extensions of one's will, who are dedicated to the pursuit of our interests, narrowly defined. But we might instead orient our attention toward the development and expression of the self as a moral agent, who works in concert with other moral agents, who necessarily have the same ends. The most relevant form of self-determination here is not the exercise of choice that distinguishes one as an individual, but rather the exercise of judgment that represents one's recognition of one's duties and one's required effort to contribute to their joint realization. A collective of people who do so together will, of course, in the process, generate distinctive ways of discharging those duties, partly because many of them involve indeterminacy and choice in their execution. Distinctive modes of execution will also result because of possibly inevitable good faith disagreements about the content, scope, and proper execution of our shared duties and the variable compromises that will emerge from these disagreements. These distinctive modes of execution, supplemented by the pursuit of secondary discretionary ends consistent with duty, are going to individuate collectives. Such individuation is entirely welcome. It's an important aspect of inspiring citizen attachment and spurring experimentation and innovation. But although there is a dimension of collective self-expression as individuation in collective political activity, it rests on top of and does not operate independently of what I posit is the main purpose of political activity and thus the main purpose of representation, namely, to execute our collective moral duties. Thank you.